All right, we're going to get started. I'm here to announce this next speaker, Dr. Hillary Baldwin. She is a board-certified dermatologist and medical director of the Acne Treatment and Research Center in Brooklyn, New York. She is a clinical associate professor of dermatology at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical Center. That's a mouthful. And served as a founding board member and second president of the American Acne and Rosacea Society. Please welcome Dr. Baldwin.
Knee gets replaced on February 16th, and I cannot wait to not go up the stairs like that. I'm not having a good time with it. So it's a pleasure to be here to talk about acne and rosacea part two. And this time I thought, the same disclosures as yesterday, and this time I thought I'd start with rosacea. It always gets the short end of the stick, so I thought we'd start with that one first today. Recognizing that a whole bunch of famous people have this condition, and frankly, some of them don't seem to care all that much. And you see also that there's a big familial tendency on this slide. So it's very common, about 10% worldwide, counting up to about 16 million in the United States. It's said to be the most common skin disease in fair-skinned Northern European women. Now, I practice in the heart of Brooklyn, New York. If only Northern European women got rosacea, I never would have seen it. So it's very common in patients of color. It's very common in men, although it is more common in women. But phimas are way more common in men, and we don't know why. A couple of years ago, Andrew Alexis and a couple of the rest of us took a look at rosacea in patients who are more richly pigmented. And we came to the conclusion that it is not rare, although it's much less common in patients of color. It's certainly not rare in darker skin. But the erythema may be more difficult to recognize, especially in skin type 5 and 6, for example. So we need to keep a very high index of suspicion when we see a darker-skinned patient with pimples on the face, especially if they're 30 years old or older and didn't have a history of acne before then. Sometimes it's easier to ask about symptoms than it is to look for the erythema. You can ask for symptoms like itch and burn, and maybe even they can tell you that periodically their face feels warm to the touch. So even though you can't appreciate the erythema, you know it's there. So asking questions may be more easy than taking a look at them clinically, and recognize that a diagnosis not considered is a diagnosis not made. So we're not going to talk about pathophysiology for long, just to mention that, of course, we're well aware on the right side of this slide that we have an inflammatory condition, right? Primarily with triggering of the cathelicidin pathway, but also with the adaptive immune system, with an increase in mast cells and neutrophils and macrophages and T cells, all of which creates this milieu of inflammation and edema and pain and neurogenic symptoms in predisposed individuals after they've been exposed to whatever trigger it is that triggers them. And sometimes, of course, they can tell you that. For me, it's red wine, unfortunately. But for some people, they don't even know what their triggers are. There's something out there triggering them because the disease comes and goes and waxes and wanes, but we don't know what it is. But I'd like to focus for a moment on the barrier dysfunction concept of rosacea that we don't talk about very often. Rosacea is clearly a barrier deficiency disorder. We know that transepidermal water loss is elevated, that the stratum corneum hydration is decreased, and we know that patients complain of itch and sting and burn, which is what people with barrier deficiency do. But it's also in papulopustular disease. We think usually of the vascular people as the one who are complaining of itching and burning and stinging. But this study, actually it's two studies, Helen Torak and Bonnie Alusky together, looking at three different groups of people with papulopustular disease, all of whom have a very high incidence, as you can see, of itching and burning and stinging. So it's a question that you should ask everyone who comes in with rosacea, not just the red folks. The consequences of this is that the barrier deficiency facilitates the penetration of all the things that aren't supposed to be entering into the skin, and it fails to adequately protect those very sensitive nerve endings on the surface of the skin. It allows vasodilation and flushing, and it enables this vicious cycle of prolongation of disease and flare-ups. Indeed, we're not sure which is the chicken and which is the egg. Is it the barrier deficiency as the primary problem in rosacea, which causes the vascular and immune system dysfunction? Or is it the inflammatory mediators and alterations in the vasculature that elicit the barrier dysfunction? We don't know which one is which. But it kind of doesn't matter, because it looks like we can solve the problems at the very same time. And the problem is solved by good skin care. Improper skin care has been shown to worsen rosacea in several studies. Good skin care has been shown to improve rosacea even without treatment. All you have to do is institute good skin care and take away from them their alkaline soaps, for example, and their scrubs and their hot water. Good skin care also improves the ability of our patients to use the medications that could make them better, but they can't use it because it causes too much irritation. One of the most important things to look for in taking care of their skin is to make sure that the cleanser is an acidic pH cleanser. Now, this is not that easy to find out. I wanted to make a list of the pH of cleansers. I had to go to each company individually and ask them for the pH of each one of the products. It was a big job. It's not like it's listed on the label. You can't tell your patient to go out and make sure they get an acidic pH cleanser. So you have to make a specific recommendation for something that's going to end up with normal or physiologic pH down around 4 to 6. So they have a lot to choose from when they go to the pharmacy. They might choose an antibacterial soap. We know that's a bad idea, but they think they've got pimples, they probably have acne, it's caused by bacteria. Let me grab Zest or Irish Spring or Dial with a pH way up there at 10 to 12. Or true soaps like your Ivory, which is down at 9 to 10, but still highly alkaline. And what we really want them to do is to go out there and get their Sindets and their lipid-free liquid cleansers down between 4 and 7. But again, you have to make specific recommendations. Whatever that might be for you, grab stuff from your closet, give them an example of what you want them to get when they go to the pharmacy. Another thing that causes a lot of problems for our patients is cosmetics. So you want to make sure that you teach your patient to fard appropriately. This is a real thing. The Oxford English Dictionary defines to fard, a verb, as to apply cosmetics in order to conceal facial blemishes. What a great word, right? As in, pardon me, honey, while I go to the bathroom to fard. So we want to make sure that they're not using heavy cosmetics. They're going to have to scrub to get off. You know the trick about the drop of green concealer, right? A drop of green into the cosmetics in order to reduce the redness. Quality emollients before they put on their cosmetics. And ask them to choose something with a matte finish. Shiny stuff generally itches. Have you ever wondered what's in the shiny stuff? Sometimes it's metal flakes, sometimes it's fish scales. And they do tend to be sharp, and they can cause irritation. Moisturizers, you want to stick with silicone and petrolatum-based moisturizers that tend not to be very irritating. You want to avoid humectants, pure humectants, which draw water in. And especially in dry climates, that means the humectant is sort of sucking water out of the stratum corneum. And physiologic lipids are always helpful. Ceramides, free fatty acids, cholesterol, to repair that barrier. So the bottom line is that, like acne, no rosacea visit is complete until you've discussed all of the skin care that they need to know about. So now let's talk about treatment. We have a lot to talk about here. And start with papules and pustules. How do we pick that first one, the first product that we're going to use? I base it on severity, but also on patient preference. Do they like pills? Do they like creams? Do they like ointments? Do they like lotions? What is it that they're going to use? Would they be willing to use both if they have severe disease? Because obviously, if I pick the wrong one, it's never going to get used. We have some newer FDA-approved topicals, which are so much better than the old products that we have. I use exclusively these unless the insurance company requires me to utilize some of the older products that I'm not even going to discuss today. Oral medications, we have the FDA-approved sub-antimicrobial dose doxycycline, but we also have sarecycline. We have some news on that one, too. It's, of course, FDA-approved for the treatment of acne, but it's been looked at for rosacea now as well. So we're just going to talk about these three. Let's start with minocycline 1.5% foam, known as Zilxi. Obviously, minocycline, a very well-established molecule with a lot of reasons to use it for rosacea, an excellent anti-inflammatory drug. Also, it turned 50 last year. Happy birthday to Minnow. But still, global resistance rates remain low. It's as if minocycline is sort of resistant to resistance. It's been shown to be highly effective orally in the treatment of rosacea, but we all know that although rare, systemic side effects of minocycline can be very significant. It took 50 years for them to figure out how to make a topical preparation of minocycline. It turns out mineral oil is the trick, and so they have a nice reduction of inflammatory lesions of about 60% at 12 weeks. But look at what happened at week 4. They've already lost about 40% of their lesions as early as week 4. Now, probably because of the mineral oil, it has virtually no cutaneous side effects. So it's a product that you can give to your rosacea patients with confidence. You might be saying, though, oh, wait a minute. We always talk about not using a monotherapy antibiotic. Don't I need to use benzoyl peroxide along with my topical minocycline to prevent the development of resistant organisms? Good thought. So let's take this story. Supposing you start with a population of primarily susceptible organisms with one or two resistant organisms, and you treat it with antibiotics, with a relatively low dose of antibiotics. You kill off all the susceptible ones, leaving behind the resistant ones. Now there's no competition. There's plenty of food, there's plenty of hotel rooms, right? So they multiply, and you end up with a population of maybe resistant bacteria. Now, this is not made up. This is actually happens in real life. This is a model of what happens. The gray line is the susceptible organisms dropping like a stone, and the black line is the resistant organisms gradually increasing as the susceptible ones go down. This kind of a graph can be drawn for every single bug-drug combination that there is. Here we see Pseudomonas and Streptomycin. This is something that's done regularly by immunologists and by infectious disease experts. So it turns out that there is a very low concentration of antibiotics and a very high concentration of antibiotics that tend not to cause problems with antibiotic resistance. Here we've graphed the rate of evolution of drug resistance to drug concentration. And you can see all the way over on the left, below the MIC for that antibiotic, very little in the way of resistance. Now, MPC is probably something you're not familiar with. It's the mutant protection concentration. And above that, it kills everything. The concentration of drug is so high that it kills all the resistant organisms, all the susceptible organisms, and resistance doesn't occur. It's in the middle where you're wishy-washy about your dose that you run into trouble. So let's go back to talking about topical minocycline on the left here. This is a study for 21 days. 1.5% foam was applied to the skin. And you see the plasma levels on day 1 and all the way up to day 21, very low. 1.3 nanograms per milliliter. On the right side is what happens if you take a single dose of extended-release minocycline orally. And you see the levels in the plasma are about 850 nanograms per milliliter, about an 800-fold difference. So what we're saying then is that with this medication in the body, concentration super low. On the skin, concentration super high. So maybe we don't have to worry about it. And in one study, it was shown that spontaneous mutation frequency was less than 1 in 100 million. But if you still want to use benzoyl peroxide along with it, you've got one now. The microencapsulated 5% benzoyl peroxide, known as Epsilay, where the benzoyl peroxide has been encapsulated inside a silica shell. So you take the benzoyl peroxide crystal, and you cover it with a negatively charged surfactant, and then you put it in a beaker of positively charged silica monomers, and they snap together like a magnet. And then you can do it over and over again, surfactant, monomer, making it as thick as you want. Now you have basically a cabbage head with all these leaves piled up. And of course, the lipids and phospholipids from the skin can eke in, grab little bits and pieces of benzoyl peroxide and take it back out again slowly, so you don't end up with a big bolus on the skin all at one time, resulting, as you'll see in a moment, with very little issues of tolerability. An excellent result in mean inflammatory lesion count reduction. At the end of 12 weeks, now we're up at 70%. And again, a 40%, more than 40% reduction, but this time at 2 weeks. Take a look at this picture. Look at her all the way over on the left, severe, wouldn't you say? All the way over on the right, she's at mild. But look at her at week two. Dramatic improvement in only 2 weeks. So I would call this a success. Would you call this a success? Well, it was a treatment failure. So not only was the success rate 50%, but she didn't even count. What about tolerability? Tolerability actually improved with use. Normally, we look at tolerability to make sure that the medicine isn't causing tolerability issues, but here it actually resolved the tolerability problem that many of our rosacea patients have, itching and burning and stinging and redness at baseline, actually got better. So what about sarecycline? FDA approved, of course, for the treatment of acne, as we said. We know that the tetracyclines are very well documented for treating the inflammatory lesions of rosacea. But since 2003, we've been focusing our attention on sub-antimicrobial dose doxycycline, the 40 milligram modified release formulation, because it was shown to have an absence of demonstrable antibiotic resistance. But sometimes it's not that easy to get. And sarecycline, amongst all of the tetracyclines, has shown to be the most narrow spectrum. In fact, a 16 to 32-fold reduction in attacking the anaerobic gram-negative gut flora compared to minocycline and doxycycline. And spontaneous mutations way down at less than 1 in 10 billion. So of all the tetracyclines, if you're going to use something full dose to treat a condition which is not an infectious condition, sarecycline was taken out for a spin. 12 weeks, placebo-controlled, pilot study, 102 people with moderate to severe inflammatory rosacea treated with a standard dose of sarecycline, which is 1.5 mg per kg per day. The results were IgA improvement, statistically significantly superior to the placebo, inflammatory lesion reduction also, burning, stinging, and itching also, and no significant side effects. So I think we look forward to a larger study with this medication moving forward. The last drug I'd like to mention for papulopustular disease is isotretinoin. Anybody use isotretinoin for rosacea? I'm speaking to the choir here. Reduces the size of sebaceous glands, reduces sebum production, reduces cutaneous blood flow, and has numerous anti-inflammatory properties. So it's got a lot of reasons why it would be helpful for treating rosacea. Since 1981, it's been shown to be effective. Numerous case reports with doses as low as 0.1 milligrams per kilogram per day for severe rosacea, recalcitrant, refractory, and granulomatous disease. It's been shown to improve papules, pustules, ocular disease, to halt progression of phimas. So you've got somebody whose phima is getting rapidly worse. It can stop that progression. and you even get a little bit of an improvement in existing thymus. It is, after all, composed primarily of sebaceous gland material, right? And you also can see a reduction in erythema, so it really sort of does everything. The problem is isotretinoin use in rosacea, unlike in acne, is merely remittive. As soon as you stop it, the disease tends to come back. So you're going to have to continue, but you can continue with a very low dose. I usually start at 10 to 20 a day, and then I just keep decreasing and decreasing until I start to have problems. Most of my patients are on 10 milligrams twice or three times a week, indefinitely. Now, of course, you still have to do appropriate monitoring. You still have to follow iPledge rules. But if you're dealing with a male patient on a very low dose, you know, you can sort of, I don't want to say I bend the rules, but you can't even give somebody less than 30 pills in a month, right? Because it comes in a box. So that 30-pill box is going to last them for a couple of months. So what about vascular disease? When we're talking about vascular disease, we've got a couple of different things to think about with rosacea, a couple of different reasons why somebody might be red. They might have persistent facial erythema. That's the usual redness that we see with rosacea, background erythema sometimes we call it, which can be treated with alpha agonists like oxymetazoline and brimonidine. Flushing, which does not respond well to the alpha agonists, for which we usually use beta blockers with limited success and perhaps neuromodulators. Perilesional erythema, which is just the redness that surrounds the lesions themselves, and that redness goes away when the papules and pustules go away. And finally, telangiectasias that are going to need you to haul out laser or light. So let's start talking about the alpha agonists first. As I said, they really only work in those small vessels as background erythema. They do not work in telangiectasias, and they don't do much for flushing, and they don't work for perilesional erythema either, very specifically for that red face. But in that red face, they do a bang-up job. They do a very nice job eradicating redness. This is a one grade improvement in the middle and a two grade improvement over on the right. I can't tell the difference between them, but the FDA insisted on a two grade improvement. Now, I used to tell these patients, I'm going to give you a tube of medication, and you can use it every day, or you know what, you can use it just on the days that you care. Because on Monday morning, you're going to wake up, you're going to be red, you're going to put on the medication, you're going to get unred. When you wake up on Tuesday morning, you're going to be red again, right? It doesn't last. It's not permanent. So frankly, if it's a Sunday and you're staying home reading newspapers and eating bonbons with your dog, maybe you don't need to put on your oxymetazoline that day. Boy, was I wrong. We have, in the 52-week study for oxymetazoline, it was demonstrated that there was disease modification in people who were using the medication every day and not taking a day off for bonbons with the dog. So this gentleman, these are all the pictures for him from the long-term safety study. First column is pre-dose, second is 3 hours later, last is 6 hours later. And that's done on day 1, 4, 26, and 52. Right? So let's call out pre-dose on day 1 and pre-dose on week 52, which are blown up on the right. Now you can see on day 1, before he's had his medication applied, clearly he's red. He had to be, otherwise he wouldn't have been entered into the study. But on day 52, when he showed up at the study center, he was already unred, and he hadn't put his medicine on yet. So there was some actual permanent effect for him. I shouldn't have said permanent. There was some effect for him that had lasted without the need to put on the medication every day. Now, it wasn't just him. It was actually the mean of the people in the study. So what we're looking at here is the percent of patients who achieve success, which is a two-grade improvement, over time. And in green, we have 3 hours after application. And in pink, we have 6 hours after application. But it's the purple that interests me. That's before the dose that day. So on the first day, of course, there's nobody. Everybody who entered into the study had to have redness. But as time went on, the number of patients who were unread before putting on the medication increased further and further. So there does seem to be some sort of disease modification taking place with this drug. So I no longer recommend that people take days off. What about beta blockers for erythema and flushing? We used to have just propranolol and nadolol, and at the doses that you needed to control the flush, there were a lot of people with hypotension and bradycardia. But carvedilol blocks not only beta 1 and 2, but also alpha 1, and at very low doses, as you can see here, increasing is tolerated over time, it's been shown to reduce erythema and flush by 2 grades. And the patients say, you know what? Red wine used to trigger me, and it doesn't anymore. And side effects are rare. So I suggest that you give it a try. It doesn't work in everybody, but in some people, it's very helpful. What about botulinum toxin? That's been looked at in several studies. And this study here is a systematic review of all of the studies that were out there. They found 9 of them that were worthy of discussing, that were in a case report of maybe one person, right? They had a total, in all of the studies, of only of 130 people, so it's not a massive group of people who's been evaluated with this. The study protocols were too varied, the designs were too weak, and the N was too low for definitive conclusions to be drawn. But some of the patients in the studies had temporary paralysis of the facial musculature, and it does seem to help some of the erythema. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty happy with oxymetazoline and brimonidine for reducing erythema, and for that matter, energy-based treatments as well. But I might consider this for somebody who has bad flushing. So now let's move on to acne, which also plagues lots of famous people and is the most common disease that comes into our offices. So I often ask groups, how long does it take you when you walk into the room and you see a patient sitting there, a brand new patient for the very first time, how long does it take you to know what you would treat them with, all other things being equal? Is it less than a minute? Less than 30 seconds? Most people, right? I'd say about 5-10 seconds. All the rest of the time, we're making deals, right, with insurance companies and how many times you're willing to put it on and are you willing to use pills and all that sort of thing. But you know right away. How did you do that? I did it by looking at what kind of lesions they had. Are they inflammatory, comedonal, a combination of both? Within that realm, is it mild, moderate, or severe? And then is there scarring? Because scarring, of course, ups the ante dramatically. Is there psychological impairment? That's going to take me a few more minutes. But frankly, I rarely find out if there's psychological impairment on that first visit anyway, because if I'm lucky, the teenage boy says, ooh. It's the most I ever get out of them. And I'm not sure if that's psychologically impaired or not. But with time, you may find that out. You can ask mom. She'll answer. He'll say, no, that's not true. They'll get into a fight. You'll go see another patient and come back. Does the patient desire to be treated? Lots of teenagers are dragged in kicking and screaming by their mothers, and they don't give a rat's butt, right, about their acne sometimes. So it's important to find out, because if they don't care, they're not going to use their medication, and this is all a waste of time. What about their ability to tolerate side effects? This is something that I think you can figure out on that very first visit. There are intolerable medications, and then there are intolerant individuals. And you all know what I'm talking about, right? So we could also perhaps call them weenies. And everything irritates their skin. And you can do, remember when you used to, when you went through the positive review of systems, and the way you got out of that is that you asked them if their teeth itched and if their hair hurt? Right? So you can ask a bunch of questions. Does water bother you? To find out if you've got somebody there who's going to be bothered by anything that you use. And that's going to change the frequency, maybe even choose alters the way you choose the medication that you're going to use. So how do we do that so quickly? How did you do that in 5 seconds? We have to convince the patient to trust us, don't we? I do that by education. I spend a lot of time educating my patients. Believe it or not, I even make a cross on my piece of paper and I point out, paper, by the way, is something made from a tree. You're probably not familiar with it anymore, but I have it in my office. I make a cross and I put the 4 pillars of acne pathogenesis, and then I put the medication that I'm choosing in each one of the quadrants so that they understand why this is a combined effort. Otherwise, they buy 2 things and not the third. They come back and they say, that one didn't work, so I didn't use it. How on earth did they know that? If they were using all 3 drugs, how did they know that that one didn't work? But they do that a lot. So education is very important. We know that combination therapy is the key. The average successfully treated patient is on 2.53 different medications. But we've also been told, keep it simple, stupid. Otherwise, the patients are not going to adhere to your regimen. So use a lot of drugs, don't use a lot of drugs. How do you figure this out? Well, a fixed combination product is the best answer for this, right? Pick something that's got 2 drugs in it. Soon we're going to have one with 3 drugs in it. And get all the medications over with in 1 or 2 applications. That's my trick. I'm sure it's your trick as well. The other thing, though, is to keep tolerability as good as you can. And also to give the patient as few rules as possible. You know, you don't want to say, put this one on 3 hours before that one, which goes on just before you wash your face, and then put this one on right at, no rules, as few rules as possible. And I believe that branded products with excellent vehicles are the answer to my personal success. I'm a tertiary referral center. Patients come into me having used virtually every medication there is, and I have to put them back on the very same medications because I got nothing else. So what I'm doing different from what the other doc did is that I'm switching them from generic, intolerable products to beautiful branded products with excellent vehicles, or a beautiful pill that has wonderful, all sorts of bells and whistles, and all of a sudden they get better. Is it me? No. It's the drugs I picked. So let's start talking about topical retinoids, because that's the quintessential place in which vehicle matters more than almost anything. We know it inhibits the formation of the microcomedo. It reduces mature comedos, so it gets rid of the ones you have and prevents the ones that are coming. It reduces inflammatory lesions also, enhances the penetration of other medicines with which it's co-applied, and it maintains remission in acne by inhibiting, again, the microcomedo formation, which is the mother of all lesions to follow. There is no such thing as a person who is retinoid intolerable, and retinoids should be part of everybody's regimen. Everyone can be on a retinoid. When I was at Downstate many years ago, the only drug we had on formulary was Tazorac gel, 1%. That's a hard thing to overcome, right? I heard somebody laughing. That's a hard drug to start someone on. But we started everybody on it, maybe twice a week, maybe with moisturizer underneath it, diluted half and half, whatever we had to do. But everybody ended up being able to utilize a retinoid. Every other day, barrier repair, moisturize first, switch to a milder active if you can. Most important, grab a branded product with a quality vehicle that reduces tolerability issues. Topical antimicrobials, we have clindamycin. Please don't use erythromycin. It doesn't work. Throw it out. Throw it out of your vocabulary. Throw it out in general. Benzoyl peroxide and the new minocycline. So benzoyl peroxide, it is the hero of the day. It's 60 years old, and it's still as important as it ever was. It treats acne, kills C. acnes faster and more effectively than all of those antibiotics. Alone, it significantly improves both inflammatory and, to some extent, non-inflammatory lesions. But it's kind of a pain in the neck, you have to agree, with the bleaching and all those kind of issues. It reduces also, though, the risk of antimicrobial resistance. So I'm using it to make the acne better, but also so that I can use an oral antibiotic. Benzoyl peroxide is not associated with antimicrobial resistance, and it reduces the incidence of resistance when co-applied with a topical or co-administered with an oral antibiotic, and can even reverse resistant strains. So I don't know how I would practice. And you know, every now and then you have somebody who comes in who claims they're allergic to benzoyl peroxide. Most of them aren't. Usually it's an irritation, not an allergy. But on occasion, you have somebody who's truly allergic to benzoyl peroxide, and it's very difficult to make their acne better. Oral antibiotics, we have numerous ones. We have mostly the tetracycline class, with sarecycline the newest kid on the block. If I have somebody, though, who comes in, some crazy woman who comes in 1 month before her wedding with a face full of pimples, there's only one drug that might be able to save me from annihilation, and that's trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, along with a little bit of prednisone. It's the only thing that's going to clear that up that fast. Otherwise, I don't use it. It's my emergency fallback measure. You can also use trimethoprim alone, get rid of the sulfa, if you're worried about Stevens-Johnson and agranulocytosis and all those other things that make us concerned about sulfa drugs. Azithromycin and amoxicillin also have data for acne, but these are not anti-inflammatory medications, so they're just killing C. acnes. Never use as monotherapy, always use with benzoyl peroxide, and always use for the shortest duration possible. Now, yesterday we commented that 3 month rule, you've all heard the 3 month rule for antibiotics, right? Don't use antibiotics any longer than 3 months. Do you know where that came from, that number? It was plucked from the sky by somebody so long ago that we don't even remember who it was. There is no data that says that 3 months is this magic number. Use antibiotics for as little time as possible. And frankly, if that has to be 5 months or 6 months, well, that's what it has to be. But, you know, once you cross the 3 month mark, for, you know, I'm thinking spironolactone, I'm thinking isotretinoin, I'm thinking of a way to get myself out of this mess, is what I'm thinking about, because the patient becomes psychologically addicted to the high efficacy of the oral antibiotic. But you gotta get them off of it, clearly. So, how are we gonna pick doxy, mino, sarecycline? Well, let's look at the impact of food and dairy, because that makes people kind of miserable. You have to give them rules, right? If you want maximum absorption of doxycycline, it has to be taken 2 hours on either side of a meal. That's a deal breaker for a teenage boy. I don't have, nor have I ever been, a teenage boy, but I've been told that they never stop eating. And this 2 hour on either side of an hour, either side of a dose is a ridiculous rule. But minocycline and sarecycline are unaffected by stomach contents. Photosensitization is an issue only for doxycycline, especially at the higher dose, not mino or sera. Esophagitis is an issue for doxycycline as well. You want to make sure that the patient takes it with a nice big 8-ounce glass of water and sits up for a good 30 minutes before reclining. That does not happen with mino and sera. Mino can be associated with those rare but very significant side effects. Sarecycline, on the other hand, has very low incidence of side effects. And then if you have somebody who can't take pills, I'm in Brooklyn, so what I say to people who can't take pills is, well, learn. But if you can't do that, there is a suspension available for doxy, and some of the minnows can be crushed or opened. So now, how about oral contraceptives? Oral contraceptives are FDA approved for the treatment of acne in patients desiring contraception. Look at that label carefully. That means that if you're obeying the FDA rules, this is not something that can be used in someone who doesn't want to have birth control, right? Obviously, I ignore that all the time, but just to point that out to you, moderate to severe acne in patients over the age of 15 who have been menstruating for at least a year. There's only 4 that are FDA approved in the United States for the treatment of acne, but they all work. usually takes, though, a very long time to see an effect. So I usually combine them with other medications. My favorite thing to do is to start oral contraceptives, or for that matter, spironolactone, at the same time as an oral antibiotic. And just as I'm getting desperate to stop the oral antibiotic, the medications start to kick in. Very important that you take a history. Lots of contraindications for oral contraceptives. I have this written on a handout, and if I can see that we're headed towards the direction of starting an oral contraceptive, I'll give them the handout and go and see another patient and come back, because they really need to pay attention to this. Spironolactone, doses of 25 to 200 milligrams a day. Awesome drug. I use it all the time. My biggest complaint is that y'all have found out how great a drug it is. What used to happen is people would come to me saying, I've tried everything. And I could confidently say, well, you haven't tried spironolactone. And now they frequently have. The response also takes a long time. Very few side effects, mostly nuisance, breast tenderness, menstrual irregularities. Sometimes they call diuresis a side effect. It's not. It's an effect of this medication. It makes you pee. It's a diuretic. That's its purpose. And potassium concerns, I'm sure you're aware, have been found to be largely a non-issue in young, healthy individuals taking 100 milligrams or less for acne. It is not FDA approved for the treatment of acne in the United States, just in case that matters to you. But after I tell my patients that, I turn around and say, however, 95% of prescriptions written for spironolactone in the United States are for androgen-related disorders in women. So it may not be FDA approved for that, but that's why we use it. You also need to absolutely make sure you tell your patients about the fact that it is FDA approved for the treatment of high blood pressure, because they're gonna go on the internet and they're gonna think you're crazy. So make sure you let them know that why it is that this works for both conditions and that you know they don't have high blood pressure, yada, yada. Save yourself the effort of the return phone call. Isotretinoin, awesome drug. We could spend the whole hour talking just about this, indicated for nodulous cystic acne in patients who are unresponsive to conventional therapy, including antibiotics. That's the full statement, which means that technically, if somebody walks in clearly an isotretinoin candidate, you're not supposed to start there. You're supposed to start somewhere else. Maybe just for a month if you want, and then go on to isotretinoin. Only therapy that can promise a cure 80% of people without acne for the rest of their lives if they complete a course. But numerous potential side effects, as you're well aware. But few of them actually occur. I tell my patients that the side effect list in the package insert is two sides of a piece of paper, three columns, font two, right? That's pretty much what it is. It's basically everything that has ever happened to a human body. Because it's been out for 40 years and the FDA requires anything that's been reported in more than two people to go in that package insert. There's nothing that hasn't happened in 40 years to 60 million people, right? So everything's in there. So our job is to help the patients to separate hype from reality. And reality is only four things happen in more than 1% of the population. Dry mucous membranes, 100%. Musculoskeletal aches and pains, about 18%. Liver and enzyme elevations, not necessarily abnormalities, just higher than it was, but still normal most of the time, 11%. And triglycerides, about 25%. Everything else is below 1%. Now, the thing they're most worried about, depression. So we have a nice meta-analysis. I'm sorry, the reference got cut off. I know I put it on there. Anyway, I'll give it to you if you wish. A nice meta-analysis of 31 studies on patients receiving isotretinoin. The answer, it stops depression. It relieves depression. Mean depression scores decreased in the patients who were on isotretinoin compared to those who were not. I need to mention pseudoacne fulminans because everyone who prescribes isotretinoin needs to know about this, and that is not the case. I have now been deposed 27 times on this issue with isotretinoin. So back in 2017, we all got together to do a consensus group on bad acne, basically. And we coined this term, pseudoacne fulminans, to be different from regular acne fulminans, which is explosive acne along with systemic signs and symptoms. Elevated blood pressure, fever, malaise, bone abnormalities. And we coined this term to be explosive acne after the institution of isotretinoin. There are about 200 case reports in the literature, and you see explosive worsening after the first month of initiation of therapy. Way more common in men, more common in very inflamed acne, and more common in truncal involvement. There's no systemic symptoms, and scarring is virtually a guarantee. So you take somebody with isotretinoin-worthy acne, which probably would have scarred to begin with, and you multiply it 10 to 100-fold, and now you've got horrendous scarring that didn't need to happen. So, avoidance and treatment. If you see somebody who's high risk, a male, very inflamed trunk, start at 10 milligrams a day and maybe even add some prednisone right from the get-go. At the very least, I have the patient have a filled bottle of prednisone at home so they can call me. I give them my cell phone number, by the way. Every isotretinoin patient of mine has my cell phone and permission to call 24 hours a day. Nobody ever does, once in years, but I think it makes them feel better. They're to call me, to send me a photograph, and they can start prednisone right away because it's on their bedside table. If it's already happened, and this is why I get deposed, stop or reduce the isotretinoin dose by at least 50% and add prednisone 1 mg per kg per day. The natural reaction when you've given somebody isotretinoin and they're getting worse is to increase the dose. And therein lies the depositions. Decrease the dose, add the prednisone, and then you have this yin-yang situation where you slowly decrease the prednisone, slowly add the isotretinoin back or increase the dose until you're finally just on isotretinoin because paradoxically, although it caused the problem, it's also the solution. Okay, so the last 5 years, explosion in new products. Look at this list. Altreno 0.05 tretinoin lotion, which was in the special polymeric emulsion technology that reduced irritation. Aklief, our first fourth generation retinoid, binding only to the gamma receptor. Araslo, which is tazarotene 0.045% lotion, that basically cut out all of the irritation of tazarotene thanks to polymeric emulsion technology. Twinio, our new combination of benzoyl peroxide and tretinoin. Amzeeq, which is minocycline foam. Winlevi, which is clascoterone foam, the first new agent in 40 years. Seysara, which we already mentioned. Minolira, which is extended release minocycline. Absorica LD. And soon to come, our first triple combination of Clinda, benzoyl peroxide, and adapalene. So we're going to look at just a couple of these quickly. We already looked at minocycline foam for rosacea. This is 4% for acne with a nice resolution of inflammatory lesions. And once again, since it's made in mineral oil, hardly any side effects. Microencapsulated benzoyl peroxide, 3%, tretinoin 0.1%. Now some of you are saying, hold the phone. Benzoyl peroxide and tretinoin can't be put together. We can't even co-apply them. Benzoyl peroxide is a potent oxidizer. Tretinoin is a weak, fragile molecule. It gets eaten by benzoyl peroxide, and it doesn't work anymore. Also, you're giving me benzoyl peroxide and the strongest tretinoin that there is in combination, and you think this is going to be tolerable? Well, thanks to microencapsulation, that's exactly what happened. So we said before, microencapsulation, the ingredients are separated by the silica shell. So in the bottle, the benzoyl peroxide is kept in its hidey hole, and tretinoin is kept in its hidey hole. So the reason why they can be put together in the same bottle is because they don't touch each other. And then, again, thanks to that slow exit from the silica shells, you don't see the tolerability problem that you thought you would. So here is efficacy, phase 3 mean inflammatory lesion reduction, with the drug in purple and the vehicle in gray. And here's tolerability. That lowest bar represents mild, and you can see the signs on the left and the symptoms on the right. Nothing above mild at any time point for any parameter. You do have that little blip at 2 weeks, which is standard for every retinoid in the world. Clascoterone cream, first new mechanism of action since isotretinoin. Androgen receptor inhibitor with anti-inflammatory properties, rapidly metabolized into the skin into a non-androgen, which means it can be used by men safely. That's the first sebum inhibitor, anti-androgen medication that we have, other than isotretinoin, that can be used in men, right? So big deal. Here we're looking at a success of 2-grade improvement and attaining the status of clear or near clear, clascoterone in the green, giving you about a 20% success rate with good tolerability. And lastly, this is that triple combination that's due to come out next year. So a bear of a study, 150 patients in each of 5 arms. We have the vehicle, we have the triple in the dark blue, and then we have all of the various duads in the lighter blue and the pink. So you can see at about 8 weeks, the triple combination starts to exert its activity. And by week 12, a highly statistically significant difference between it and each one of the duads that we've been using for years with success. So it beat out all of them by a long shot, as you see. They had the guts to do this study with only 150 people in each arm. We were sure it was going to fail. We were sure it was going to need a bigger number than that in order to show statistical significance. But with that little pittance of people in the study, it showed statistical significance. So we look forward to that. Micronized isotretinoin. We talked yesterday about Leidos isotretinoin. This is micronized so that the absorption is a little bit better. 2 times the absorption of the old Leidos formulation means you can take it on an empty stomach. Why is that important? Because teenage girls don't eat breakfast, people who are on intermittent fasting don't eat breakfast, and people who eat healthy breakfast has no help. Special K with skim milk and raspberries does me no good in isotretinoin land. And very few people are going to consume this for breakfast, which is the breakfast that they were fed by the FDA. We also don't know how much the patient is absorbing if they're not eating it with that kind of a meal. And that might increase relapse. I'm going to skip this because I'm running out of time. And just finish up with truncal acne. So for truncal acne, we know it's very common, and the patients don't bother to mention it to us. More than 50% of them have it. 78% of them want us to talk about it, but we didn't. We have to have a crystal ball, right? Medication application is challenging. Medication can bleach, it can stain. So this is a problem. It's also a problem because we've been assuming for years that acne is acne is acne, and what works on the face is going to work on the trunk, but that's not necessarily the case. We only have 3 drugs with phase 3 truncal data: trifferatine, clascoterone, and sarecycline. Trifferatine set out to do this, and trunk was part of the phase 3 clinical trial. They did it scientifically from start to finish. And we see a success rate of about 40%. Sarecycline, About a tenth of their patients happened to have truncal involvement and were studied and were shown to do better than the group on placebo, as you can see here, on both the chest and the back. And clascoterone in the light blue on the trunk seems to do even better than clascoterone in the dark blue on the face. So it's another option for your truncal patients. We have some other drugs with phase 4 truncal data, dapsone, azelaic acid, and the new tazarotene 0.045% lotion. That study came out only about 2 months ago now. So it's a very small study. It's a single center, open label on only 19 patients, but look at that success rate on the left and excellent tolerability on the right. So I think we look forward to a larger study on this drug in the future. So the bottom line is our toolbox for both rosacea and acne literally runneth over. And my question to you is, what's in your toolbox today? Thank you very much for your attention. That's my email address, because I'm not going to get to all the questions. So if you have any questions, please go ahead and email them to me. I don't mind at all. Any?
Dr. Baldwin, we do have some questions. We're just pulling those up now. Perfect. Thank you for that excellent lecture.
My pleasure. It's hot up here. Can you review the dosing for trimethoprim? Oh, okay. So trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole is double-strength BID. For trimethoprim alone, it's 300 milligrams BID. If using it for emergencies with prednisone, what's the dosing for both? Dosing is the same, and I use usually about 20 to 40 milligrams a day of prednisone. I don't usually do per kilogram in that. I usually sort of eyeball the patient and do somewhere 20, 30, 40 milligrams. I also, by the way, do prednisone before weddings. Does anybody do this in acne-prone patients? So my wedding plan is 2 days before the wedding, they get 20 milligrams in the morning. 1 day before, they get 10 milligrams that morning. And it stops those last-minute jitter pimples and helps to reduce redness, too. My absolute highest cumulative dose on isotretinoin. I don't think I've hit it yet. And I've gone very high. I inherited somebody who, when they came to me, already had 400 milligrams per kilogram cumulative dose. And I continued it for a while after. So I don't really have a number. But once you get up that high, you need to do a bone survey to make sure that they're not getting calcification of the ligaments. For some reason, the wrist and the ankles are what you look at when you do the x-rays. Do you get... And it was a panoxyl. Okay. Now we're talking about, are all benzoyl peroxides created equal? No, indeed they are not. Leave-ons are much better than cleansers, to the tune of about one log difference, which is a tenfold difference in their ability to kill C. acnes. So whenever possible, you want a leave-on, not a cleanser. The other issue, of course, with cleansers is that a lot of it ends up going down the drain, depending on how hard the patient is rubbing with a towel, right? I always ask the question, if the towel bleached, where's the benzoyl peroxide? Makes me nervous. So I use a leave-on if I can. Oh, God, I hate this question. I love it, but I hate it. How do you approach a patient who wants natural treatment? I'm in New York, so my honest answer to that is that the guy down the street does a great job with this. I'm not kidding you. I don't know. I've done extensive research into it. I've never found anything that I thought would be helpful. And I end up trying to convince them that things like azelaic acid, because it comes from barley, is natural. And retinoids are really vitamin A, right? I'm serious, that's the only way I can get around it. And niacinamide, those are the things that they're willing to use, but they don't work very well. Wait, Spiro?
Oh, sorry. Ew.
Oh well, this is a good question too. How do you manage patients with acne from TRT? I presume you're meaning testosterone? For, am I right? Okay.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So we have patients who are undergoing, are going through transformation from female to male, and they are being put on testosterone. And that testosterone, just like with a teenage boy who experiences testosterone for the very first time, explode frequently with acne. We're talking more than 60, 70%, and it lasts for a very long time, just the way it does in a teenage boy, right? It takes a long time for it to, for the, whatever the heck happens in a teenage boy, when the follicles get accustomed to hormones and no longer make acne. Do you ever wonder about that? We know why people get acne, but why do they unget acne? Why does it go away? It doesn't make any sense at all. The hormones are still there. So the follicles must be coming used to the effect of the androgen hormones. So how do I manage them? You know, I almost always end up on isotretinoin because clearly you can't use spironolactone. I don't know if you can use clascoterone cream. I think you can because it's not systemically absorbed, but it's not really going to get you where you need to go, and I'm not going to put somebody on oral antibiotics for 10 years. So I usually end up with isotretinoin.
That last question that was missed was, could you please talk about your potassium checking and your labs in spironolactone patients?
Okay. So I do not check potassium for patients under the age of 45 on 100 milligrams of or less of spironolactone, because that study from Harvard that looked at more than 1,900 patients found no reason for me to do so. It's after the age of 45 where there might be a little bit of a tendency to retain potassium, especially obviously in people whose kidneys are starting to fail or getting old. But in the younger population, I don't check it at all. How do I screen patients for depression prior to starting isotretinoin? I sort of don't do that either, honestly. I have a friend, Rick Fried. I don't know if any of you know him. He's a dermatologist and a psychologist from Yardley, Pennsylvania. And what he does is he says to the patients, everybody gets sad sometimes, everybody gets depressed. In your darkest moment, where you're the saddest you've ever been in your entire life, have you ever thought of doing yourself in? And if the answer is no, he's finished. If the answer is yes, his follow-up question is, what stopped you? And if the answer is a deep and abiding faith in the Lord, the thought skeeves me, oh my God, I could never do anything like that, that's okay too. If the answer is, what stopped you? Mom came home, we got ourselves a problem, right? And I've followed with that. But he's a psychologist, he feels more comfortable doing that. Of course, I ask mom, I ask the child, and I tell them, every time you come in, we're going to be talking about how you feel on this medication. And if you feel unwell on this medication psychologically, I'm not going to take you off of it. I will help you to deal with it. Because the same Rick Fried, a genius, by the way, said to me that he has been deposed numerous times because the patients don't tell you, if they've had a wonderful response to the isotretinoin, they don't tell you that they're depressed because they don't want you to take them off of it. So you have to tell them that you'll work with them, reduce the dose, maybe add some antidepressants, go see a therapist, but I'm not going to take you off of this, I'm not going to leave you high and dry, so that they tell you the truth. Long-winded way of saying it. Rebound vasodilation with the alpha adrenergics, right? That's what you meant? Rebound erythema occurs in probably about 20% of patients on brimonidine and about 2 maybe or so on oxymetazoline. So it's much less common with oxymetazoline. The problem with all of this is that rebound was not defined correctly with the original brimonidine trial. All the FDA cared about was that 2 weeks and 4 weeks after stopping the medication, there was no change in redness, because they thought this was all a bunch of hooey. And they just wanted to make sure that this drug didn't cause problems. What they didn't ask them to do was to look at redness on Monday and redness on Tuesday. We had no data points, because you and I know that rebound is not 2 and 4 weeks later. Rebound is the next day, right? And we had no data. And they allowed brimonidine to go to market claiming that there was no rebound erythema. And there was. If we were told in the very beginning to expect it in 20% of our patients, we wouldn't have flipped out when it happened. But we were told, no, no rebounding at all. FDA's fault, frankly. So the issue with brimonidine, beyond that, is that it was 5 pea-size amount. 5 pea-size. You could cover the face 5 times with that amount. Way too much drug. And the other thing you can do is to repair the barrier first, and then brimonidine does not cause that problem. I also like to repair the barrier first for oxymetazoline, but you don't usually need to do that. So I think both drugs are great, and I use them all the time. How long do I keep patients on prednisone when treating pseudoacne fulminans? As long as it takes, and I don't mean to be evasive. Some people it's weeks. Some people, it's 6 months later. I'm still fighting with the isotretinoin prednisone. So as long as it takes. I have had the issue, though, with the patients developing massive stria from the prednisone on top of their acne, you know, stria on their bodies, of course, on top of their acne, on top of all of their scars. It's a flipping mess, to be honest with you. But unless you use prednisone in those patients at high doses, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. So you really sort of have no choice. But when you're on 1 mg/kg with a teenage boy, you really need to let him know that that stria could occur.
Dr. Baldwin, we are over time. We still have a lot more questions, but we respect your time. And how great was that, everyone? Thank you to Dr. Baldwin. And for all of you who stayed till the last minute, we do have some extra bingo words for you. So get those cards out for one last play. The word is Sunshine City, the 305, beach umbrellas, and Art Deco. Again, those words were 305, the Sunshine City, beach umbrellas, and Art Deco. Give me some bingos. Thank you. We'll see you tomorrow morning.